All right, we're in sequel world again with yet another tactical fellow. Who are you? You've been on Channel 9 before.
I have been on, yeah. Dave Campbell. Right on. Been with sequel for a long time now.
Excellent.
14 years plus.
Wow.
Yep.
And so for the context of this interview, we've been going around and talking to basically all of the thought leaders in the Azure space, our new cloud computing platform. Mm-hmm. And so we've covered, you know, Windows Azure, we've covered the .NET services, mm-hmm. we've covered live services, and next up is...
Save the best for last.
Exactly.
SQL services.
Right on.
Good, good.
Right. So what exactly, remember we came here last time for the mixed time frame, it was SSDS at that
yep.
point.
Yep.
Now we can talk about what you've actually done.
Yes. Okay. Good. So we've made a lot of progress since Mix and multiple dimensions. And part of it, this that makes it interesting is that it's like an iceberg. You know, the 90% of the hard stuff is underneath the waterline. And the piece that we're projecting for Mix was actually very small. And we've expanded that for PDC. And we're adding more and more capabilities, and we'll actually see an acceleration in terms of what we project in terms of database capabilities going forward. So, you know, we still want to have the thing be simple and approachable, but in the end, it's about having a database service, a database endpoint that is low friction. I can just go provision it. I can just go talk against it. So things you'll see for PDC, join support, order by, top, and so, you know, more of the database query capabilities. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, good stuff.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So what if I am a... so now let's go out into the future a little bit.
Okay.
And that's great for like a simple, you know, maybe a pizzeria that's mm-hmm. storing
yeah,
prices
yeah.
and whatnot.
Yeah, fine.
But if I want, you know, I have a pretty complex system where I have stored procedures.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I'm curious, because when you think of Azure, the idea is that it can run any sort of execution context in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And so what if I have complex stored procedures and I don't want to actually have a full SQL server that I have to have an admin for,
mm-hmm.
but I want to just ship up these scripts
mm-hmm.
and then they're just and they run. Is that something that we're thinking along?
Okay, that's a good question. That's in the hard part. Okay, here's
sure.
how I characterize it. So there's a point at which we can do things at scale, where we can dramatically shift the costs. And I think about it this way. In order for us to keep things sane in this world, we need to split things up such that physical data administration, you know, is my disk getting full, is my log file getting full, is not a concern for the customer, okay? But logical data administration, hey, I'd like to add a column, I want to, you know, do this a little bit, I want to go create another table, is easy to do from the perspective of the customer, okay? So SQL, the language, Transact SQL or, you know, SQL and other products, it's a challenge because, you know, I did this thought experiment over the summer. I thought about, it was probably late 80s, as an industry invented client-server databases, and broke a number of the existing assumptions, had to invent a number of things in order to pull it off. So we had to build an authentication and authorization mechanism into the database server because we couldn't rely on the transaction, you know, TP monitor database, because we were actually trying to go out and reach workstations and PCs, which weren't part of the domain, the trust domain. 3270 terminals were in the IBM world, but the PCs weren't. So we had to pull authentication and authorization into the database core. Had to go invent what it meant to address an endpoint. Actually had to abstract out, you know, levels 3 and 4 of the network hierarchy so that we could transmit over IPX, Banyan, DECnet, TCP. So a whole bunch of things that needed to change. Those same set of things need to change here when we go for, you know, database endpoint. And one of the most difficult changes is this shift in the trust boundary.
Mm-hmm.
We're no longer all running within one trust domain. So we have to be able to govern things, make sure that we can control everyone sort of in the context of the cluster. So the problem, one of the problems we face is that the language that we have, you know, SQL, has both the physical and logical constructs within it.
Mm-hmm.
So the create database statement You know, if you go down some of the clauses on there, say, hey, go put my log file on the E drive and go put my data file on the D drive here. Those don't make sense in the context of, you know, database service, right?
Because
there is no D and E drive from afar. So we need to do a lot of work to profile things. But the magic we get out of that is to reduce the friction such that I don't have to worry as someone, a consumer of the database endpoint, do I have enough room on my D and E drive to go off and do this and scale?
Yeah.
So there's a yin and yang there in terms of how we go pull this off. So you asked the question around storm procedures. So anytime someone can get into sort of a general logic, there's the governance challenge. So someone could come along and try to, you know, be clever and, you know, write the infinite loop and see how much of the CPU they can consume. And, you know, how do we constrain that? And how do we break it? And how, you know, keep it from just running away and that sort of stuff. So the way I think about this is part of what we need to do over the course of several years is to open up the capabilities over time, but always stay on that point where it's incredibly easy. We're on the right side of that cost curve, so incredibly low friction. And, you know, the capabilities will open up over time. Mm-hmm. So PDC time, and frankly for some time afterwards, we won't support just people loading stored procedures up. Now, the thought experiment we have to do, here's...
I'm famous for these curves right now, so...
Perfect.
I think about it this way. There's a set of applications, right, and in this axis I'll draw sort of the complexity of apps, database apps. And if you just look at the census, the population of all of them, it's a characteristic curve that looks like this. There are very few database applications that are over, you know, 200 spindles and all exotic and tens of thousands of tables. The bulk of the applications are sort of in this space here. So the question is, how much of the language do we need to implement to keep things very, very simple and straightforward to capture a large number of applications that make sense? So you want to find these asymmetries where can we do 30 or 40% of the language that will net us 80% of the apps in the world and that sort of thing. And so the art here right now is trying to figure out where along this curve we can go and how quickly we can drive things down to get into larger and larger. Now, the two things that are interesting here as we look at this, there's a profile. So for applications, there's a sort of relationship with respect to the trust. So if we understand and trust the application, we can bring it in and deploy it in here if we have it profiled, and there is a DBA, we know what to do and how to go tune the queries. Now, for the massive applications, the small ones that consist of 10 or 20 tables and such, we may not trust and they may not have the skills and capabilities to go off and do that, so we just have to make it work here. Mm. So the trick is being able to accommodate both of these and sort of make this natural. So we are talking to some folks around what it would mean to host databases that may contain tens of thousands of tables, may contain stored procedures and such, but it would be a different sort of relationship with those customers than it would be for just the ones that's really low friction, I can go provision and be up and running in a matter of minutes.
Great.
That makes sense?
It absolutely makes sense. And I think that's sort of a message that, you know, I guess that we're saying is that the Microsoft Cloud, mm-hmm. I mean, that's not the name of it,
yep.
So people don't get confused.
Yep.
That's just how I think about it, is really for... agility.
Yes.
For I really yes. want to quickly get yes. this up. It's not a yes. super complicated system.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a bunch of these interesting sort of relationships, and that depending on, you know, the degree at which you specify or constrain, it affords you the opportunity to do a whole bunch of interesting things. And it's kind of hard to just, you know, put it out there, but sometimes sort of shackling things a little bit allows such an advantage. And actually, you know, SQL as a language is a great example. So SQL, the language, sort of forces you to do things and reason about things in a set-based structure, okay? But having specified a query in that form, that query in that form can be optimized and parallelized, and it's amazing how much we can do. So you think about the underlying runtime in a SQL database, it's evolved tremendously over the course of the last 20 years. But the language has remained constant. Now, we were in a position with ISAMs in the past actually solving queries and doing nested loops joins ourselves and our application code. That couldn't evolve. But the specification, the, you know, a higher level specification of the query allowed so much to go on beneath the covers. So that same phenomenon happens here. So we can describe an application in terms of its logical topology. And then over time, have an SLA. And if we need more front ends to go meet the SLA, we can go spin them up. And so thinking about where those abstractions are and how to move them in a smart way really is going to add a lot of value to the customers and is going to actually shift the app model a little bit, but provide a whole bunch of benefits going forward. So
excellent. And another thing after doing these interviews, and of course you're the last technical fellow on the list, as you said, save the best for last. And no offense to anyone else, it's just sort of having fun here. But in the context of what we're doing with cloud computing, right? How do all these pieces actually work together? Okay. So if we draw the famous, now famous picture of the operating system, the cloud OS on the bottom, the services on top, and the platform surrounding it. You know, this is unusual for Microsoft because we have all these different products. Certainly they run together, right? SQL Server can't run without an operating system hosting it. But this is a much different kind of game because now we have all of these services in this cloud construct. How do they work together? How's this working together? As a developer, when do I use SQL services? When do I use the file system in the sky with Windows Azure? Can we talk about that a little
bit? Sure. I mean, I think, just to be candid, there's been a lot of confusion inside the companies we go through and wrestle with and what's the scenario. For me, I find myself being grounded as I go back to say there is an analogy with what we have running on premises right now. And I think the file system and the operating system and the database system, the analogy and what we see there in today's world still holds in the cloud. And example would be, in the file system today, in Windows, it's there. It does some things very, very well. It's easy to step up to. We know what it does. There's still room for a database. Well, some people have said, well, in the new storage system in Windows Azure, this got structured storage and tables. And stuff. I said, well, you know, before I came to Microsoft, I worked at Digital, and we had VMS, and VMS had this thing called RMS, which was structured storage in the operating system. It was an ISAM in the operating system, and we weren't confused about, you know, RMS and RDB. Other systems as well, AS400, you know, lots of systems have had structured storage like that. And the part of what we've run into with a challenge is the fact that we had to start. I talked about the iceberg and the 90% of the stuff we have beneath the covers. We only had a little bit above, and the little bit that we had above looked an awful lot like, you know, what we had in the base storage. Now, since we started talking about this 6 to 9 months ago, we've added joins, we've added order bar, we've added, you know, top. And this will look more and more like a database over time. There are interesting questions with respect to composition for when I want to have blobs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, database systems have had blobs for 20 years. In fact, the word blob came from binary large object from the database space. There's been a 20-year question. When I have an application that has structured data that I'm going to do queries around, and I also have unstructured content, it's been a case for a long time. Well, do I store the unstructured content in the file system and put the name of the file in the database, or do I store it in the database as blobs? And so that question, you know, comes up again. Now, it's interesting. In the same set of dynamics that one would use to make the decision for the last 20 years are still in play here as we go forward in the clouds. Now, what's interesting again is that over time, we've done a great job of shifting the abstraction, again, getting the abstraction in the right place so we could do the right thing under the covers. So with SQL Server 2008, we have this data type called FileStream. Now, the interesting thing about FileStream is it's something that is backed in the file system, but it has the programming model from SQL Server and from Windows. So I can get a Win32 handle and read file, write file against it. But it is all under the management and control of the database. So things are backed up consistently, they're protected and such. And so what we've tried to do is set up an abstraction that gives you the best of both worlds so you don't have to ask that question. Going forward, I imagine we'll do the same thing sort of with Azure and SQL services.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So what exactly, can we really kind of break into the box of what is called SQL services?
Yes.
What exactly is it? I mean, it's a modified SQL Server. What's going on here?
Yeah. Okay, so the, it's a great place to start. There's been a lot of talks at PDC about what we've done under the covers, and frankly, we've been somewhat tight-lipped about it because we had some interesting decisions to make several years ago. We didn't want to just take off-the-shelf SQL Server and put it up there. Because what we are trying to do, I'll start here. There's a type of thinking that you can do that says, look, I'm trying to get another 20%, I'm trying to get 50%, I'm trying to get... but in order to get breakthrough thinking, sometimes you need to step back and say, that, look, no, 50%, 100%, 200%, it's not. We need a factor 10x shift here. And what do we need to break and remake in order to get our factor 10x shift? So one of the things that we wanted to do is shift operational expense by factor 10x on those scenarios where we could support it. Again, it goes back to that curve that I drew. But we want to be in an environment where instead of just taking the off-the-shelf product, which unit by unit is much easier to manage than most others, but if we were going to host millions of databases, it would still be a tremendous burden to keep that up and running if we had millions of log files we had to manage independently. So we thought about, okay, how can we take the componentry that we've developed, pull it apart, put it back together in interesting ways that allows us to run effectively a cluster of hundreds or thousands of machines hosting hundreds of thousands or millions of databases with a couple of people running it. Exactly. And that... really is a very interesting process. The system just inherently has to be self-healing. Mm-hmm. So we've described it as you want to have 365 days by 7 by 24, just the thing has to run. And if a machine dies, unless it's got flames coming out of it and you want to go over there with a fire extinguisher, you just kind of go around and deal with it, maybe Friday afternoon or something like that. Mm-hmm. So the system inherently is self-healing. If something dies, it'll build a replica. We maintain multiple replicas of data. We have consistency in quorum protocols to make sure that we know who's mastering things. We can very, very rapidly move something from one machine to another, fail over to another machine to take over. We can control the number of replicas that we have basically dynamically based on quality of service. Do we want to have 3, 4, 5 copies? We can do that. But again, all of this is driven by configuration, all completely automated, from the laying down of the bits to the management of the running system to the monitoring, building a large-scale data warehouse of what's happening across this cluster. That's, again, in that 90% below the waterline, but it's allowed us to get this 10x shift in terms of cost. So the thing I will say is that it's been several years with some of the people who've been working on SQL Server for a long, long time. And it started as a design effort, frankly, with some architects from SQL Server and some of the pioneering database folks from MSR. Mm. And we did a joint design and started working at it. So amazing technology. We're still learning a tremendous amount. But in the end, we have something that's just incredibly amazing. We've got the power of this amazing database that we can offer in sort of a friction-free way from afar as a database endpoint over the internet.
That's amazing.
It's cool stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it just really the question, and you already answered it, but was, how do you serviceify, a standalone product? I mean, SQL Server is a super complex piece of engineering.
Yep.
Very, very incredible engineering.
Yeah.
But you have to serviceify it, which really extends what SQL was designed to do anyway.
Yes.
So this is a whole new world for everybody.
It is.
Now, as a developer, because, Channel 9 and people who usually come to Channel 9 write code, this looks to me like there's no DSL. You didn't create a new SQLite language or SQL mm-hmm. Cloud language. It's select star from orders where username, whatever. Mm-hmm. Stuff I'm used to. Will just work. So I'm just thinking, that's what I want to ask.
Okay,
what is the language?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we have today in the SQL services this flexible entity model. And by the time we talk about PDC, we'll talk about some more. But when we initially built out the cluster, we only had the capability to install a single schema across a portion of the cluster. So we built a meta schema that allowed us to describe the SSDS data model, which was authorities, containers, and then these flex entities within it. Since then, and again, it's kind of interesting to look at this outside in, but there are a lot of very, very challenging engineering problems we've been working on for several years, and it's a matter of staging them and then exposing it in a reasonable way. We've been working on installable schemas across the cluster so we can support user-defined schemas, and that gets to what we were talking about, having running many apps on this. So today's SSDS, we have a query language that we call Slink. PDC, we will show SQL support over standard SQL means, and you will see more of that emerge over the next few months. And so it's the SSDS model right now has this virtue of being very, very simple to understand. I can just walk up to it. And there are people who are not doing the entire data model first. They don't need to. This is a very approachable model for them. But we also have people who want much more of what they know today. I want to go create tables. I want to add columns. I want to select star from.
Yeah.
And so, and we will have a story for them as well.
Cool. And I guess the other thing is that since this is cloud computing, and many of the developers that we're targeting are going to be web developers. And so they live in the world of simple protocols like HTTP, REST, JSON, etc. Where does that fit into this?
Oh, that's a great question. So if I go back to the point we made a few minutes ago about when we moved to client-server databases, we had to develop formats and protocols. So how do I express a query? How do I consume the results? If you go back and look at TDS and how that was developed, very, very efficient binary protocol. The server made atomic types right with respect to the clients. So little endian, big endian, floating point formats. When I first came to Microsoft, I was actually fixing bugs in the VAX floating point formats because we had software conversion for VAX clients that connected in a SQL server. And now, those protocols made sense in the context of the LAN. In today's world, we can assume TCP. There are a set of established formats and protocols, and part of what it means to be relevant in that world is to have standard formats and protocols. Around Microsoft, we've been moving towards Astoria, which people are aware of, and the format in which results are returned is sort of an extension to APP, Atom Publishing Protocol, that we've taken back to the Standards Committee. So we very much realize that reach and approachability is super important in this world. One of the things that I guess, since this is out and it's all known now, we've done work, we'll have a Ruby Active Resource implementation for SQL services at PDC. We'll show code running, PHP and Ruby and such. That's what it means to have an endpoint that's relevant in today's world.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's cool stuff.
So I'd like to talk about from an architecture of the whole system, right? I mean, you're mainly focused on the SQL side of the house, but as a technical fellow, and this is true, you have to think outside your little box of being in the SQL product unit, and work with technical fellows, say, that are working on Azure, the OS in the cloud, and John Shushuk and company doing net services.
Yep.
So what's your take on this whole thing that we've created, and how did you, what was it like working together? And
It's been fascinating, okay? It's a new world. Everyone had their vision of what the new world was and what their role in the new world was. And over the last year, I think we all had an appreciation for this had to be bigger than just the sum of all of our efforts. And it's been the last year we've recognized what that really means and how we actually move forward with that. So across .NET services and us, the Zurich access, you know, service access control service is storing all of its information in SSDS. Our authorization authentication system, which we'll move towards and we'll show at PDC, is built on that system. So we have a mutual dependency there. It's amazing how much we've had to unlearn and relearn things that we held as true in building shrink wrap software in terms of integration. It's fascinating to integrate across different teams when you both have clusters that represent services, and how do we move those forward together? And so we've really had to build the muscle. But the real magic will come out of this platform when we can compose in a very clean way across these services to build new things that we hadn't envisioned. And that's part of the power of a platform, is to build something in which other people can build things that you had never dreamed of. And that's one of the things I really like about building platform componentry. Just walk around and see what people have then done with it to solve, you know, customer problems and such. So
absolutely.
And so you'll see the first part of that at you know, at PDC. But I think ultimately one measure of success will be, can we build an ecosystem in which other people can build services and host them within our service infrastructure that they others can compose, you know, from them themselves. And so then you start to get this effect where the thing just is multiplicative. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking to the great Steve Marks, who,
yes,
who is doing a lot of work on the Windows Azure developer side. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we talked about in our conversation was the notion of developers creating shared componentry in the cloud.
Yes.
And so that I could use their service that they,
yes,
have running. And the,
yes,
you know, and it could be a really incredible community model.
Yes.
This might take the notion of community development to a whole,
yes,
new level.
Yes.
And that's very exciting.
Yeah. I think that there's a notion of there'll be a class of people who will build service components. And then for every one person who develops a service component, it'd be great to have an ecosystem where 100 or 1,000 could consume it and wire them together to build their own sorts of things. So
yeah.
I'm really, really excited to see how this plays out over the next 3 to 5 years.
Excellent. So where, you know, you've been working a lot with Ray Ozzie, mm-hmm, and company, and he's really into simple.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like you guys are actually pulling that off.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is impressive.
Yeah, that's the, yeah. I've myself have been sort of a fan of simple, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we did differently, you know, we worked on SQL Server and started off with SQL Server 7.0 was, how do we put the power in there, but, you know, take 90% of the knobs out and just have the thing take care of itself? It takes a tremendous engineering discipline to be able to pull that off, but that's where the real magic is, where you're not fighting with the software. I mean, it's working with you to provide a solution. So, to be honest, we're still learning in that space, but I think we still hold that as, you know, being key to success. So
cool.
Still working at it.
So, and finally, what are some of the kind of open questions that, you know, maybe keep you up at night, or all of a sudden you find like, wow, where did the last 30 minutes go?
Yeah.
You know, what are some of those things that are kind,
yeah,
of like?
So here's it's kind of a weird way of answering it, but I've been involved in several what I call these big idea projects over my career, right? And some of them have the characteristic where you wake up in a cold sweat at 3 o'clock in the morning, like, oh my God, how are we going to succeed? This one, I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, going, okay, which path to success should we take first? I mean, the potential is just amazing, and for me, it's learning about new scenarios. It's really exciting to go talk to people who have problems today that they can articulate the problem, but they can't see a way of solving it, and having, you know, a database that they can get to anytime they can connect to the internet is, and putting the other data platform services into it. So I'll step back just a second. You know, SQL Server 10, 15 years ago was a relational database engine and some client libraries, you know, frankly. And today we refer to it as a data platform. We've got synchronization replication built in. We've got ETL. We've got analysis. We've got reporting. We've got data mining. And we will move the data platform to the cloud over time. So when you think about being able to have synchronization sort of built into this, we have people who want to build offline applications. Exchange is a great example. So I refer to Exchange as a data hub. I don't have to worry about my mail data. If I drop my phone or I smash my laptop, it's still protected. Now, I can walk up to any web browser. I can see my data. On my phone, I've got offline capabilities. It's the best experience I could get on the phone, my data. And on my laptop, I get the richest experience there. So that's all powered by Exchange as a data hub. Now, it probably took the Exchange and Outlook team, this is like 100 person years to go build that. It took a long time to get it. Now, if we can build that into the platform, there are many, many people who want to build offline-enabled applications, and they see the need, and they'd like to go off and do it. It's just too hard today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, going forward, those are the sorts of things that we will enable. So.
Outstanding.
That's what it is.
Well, hey, thank you for your time. It's always great to talk to you. I know you've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, we're all busy right now.
We're all busy.
Yeah.
And we'll come and talk to you again as this evolves.
Yeah, okay. So. Next time, after we get past this, we can do more of the boxes and arrows and architecture stuff. But I don't want to steal the thunder. For those going to PDC, there we have many, many talks.
Absolutely. And everybody on Channel 9 already knows all the sessions at PDC, and PDC, of course, by the time this is released, is happening, are going to be on Channel 9 from, you know, about 24 hours after they've happened.
That's going to be great.
All of them.
Good stuff.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time.
Good to see you.